It's good to see you. Man, it's something else. It is good to see you. I have been, you know, life is humbling. You get close to 50, and really close, and everything just starts falling apart. Let's just be honest. And I didn't recognize how bad these eyes have gotten. I don't know if you noticed, but for the last several times I've been teaching, I've been fishing. I've been using my fishing glasses to teach with because I use them to tie knots, and it's really good for reading my notes. The problem is when I would look up out here, you just look like a blurred mess. And so now I can do both thanks to Sean Stevens. He fixed me up, and you look great this morning, so it's good to see you. If you're visiting today, we're glad you're here. The Lord is just doing. Like I was talking this week to an individual. He was like, hey, tell me about your church. And I'm like, it's easy. Like, God is just doing stuff out there. And we are a people that just want to be a part of it. So if you're here today, that's all you need to know about this place. We love Jesus and we love each other. And we're on mission with him where he's already at work. So we're glad you're here. If you have your Bibles, turn with me to James chapter 1. We will be starting in verse 12, and we'll be getting there in just a second. How many Midwesterners do we have here this morning? Good gracious. There's something else. So here's the deal. Like, you guys are tough. You really are. You're tough in a different way. I'm from here, and from South Carolina, from Charleston, really, I guess. And you could put me on a house, roofing a house, in Columbia in July, and I would have no problem with the heat. That does not bother me. But this is as cold as I want it to get. I'm just going to be honest with you. And my wife, she when we first started dating, she took me to Iowa a couple times. First time she was smart, she took me in the summertime, which was very nice. And then she took me in January. And I don't know what was happening in the moment where I stepped outside and my eyelashes were freezing together. But I looked at her, and I said, do you want to live here? And she said, why? I was like, I don't know this is going to work out. And that's not true. I would have lived there. I just would have taken a lot of vitamin D and stayed inside from, I don't know, October to May. But anyway, all that being said, she was telling me about a story where when she was a little girl, they had gone to town. And while they were in town, it started to snow, and they call this a whiteout. When we say whiteout, what we think about is a dusting of snow, which schools out for a week, and they made the call 2 days before the snow came. Now, that's not what this was. So this was a blizzard, and so they're trying to get back home while the snow is coming down, and it turned out to be what they would call a whiteout. And in that, you can put your hand in front of your face, and you can't see your hand. And so temperatures were well below zero. They were driving, trying to get home. It got so bad, her dad had to get out of the vehicle, walk in front of the car, because then you can't see where the road ends. And if you end up in the ditch, you're done, like, because the temperatures will kill you. So to make a long story short, they start going and they find a mailbox and they go off the road to a house where they broke into the house and they knew the people and called them and let them know what was going on and waited the storm out. Now, what's the point? Here's the point. Have you ever in your life been in a circumstance, a trial, a trouble, where all of a sudden life has turned upside down? Right, where there's a path that you're so used to, that's so familiar, that's so normal, but all of a sudden it's turned upside down and that path does not look familiar anymore. We all have. And here in this moment, like, we can't look past this, who James is talking to. He's talking to Jewish Christians that are scattered all over the Mediterranean at this point because they've lost jobs, they've lost careers, they're running for their life, some of them are in jail, some of them have died. All of life is completely different, and it has happened just like that. So James, their pastor, is walking with them through this, and if you've missed any of these series, I would invite you to go back and listen We've got a study guide that's online. It's the week before, so it helps you study for today's or the next week's passage. But James, if you remember a couple of weeks ago, we started talking about these trials. And he was encouraging them, he's encouraging us, in the midst of the trial, you can do one of two things. You can run or you can remain. You can remain under, stay under, knowing that God in his sovereignty is working in the midst of the trial. We even talked about that. That's what wisdom looks like. So we come back to today's passage, and it's one of those moments where you're like, okay, James, what are you doing? Because the first words that come out of his mouth, let's read this together, starting in verse 12. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. For when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured or enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. And sin, when it's fully grown, brings forth death. So right out of the gates, he starts off with, hey, listen, this blessed life is a life that is under trial. It's in the trouble. Now, here's the confusion that we'll see this morning. There's some language confusion here that's going to get us if you don't listen. We use this Christian word blessed a lot. It's a churchy word, let's be honest. Like, we have our t-shirts that say blessed, or our coffee mugs that say blessed life, and we throw that out there a lot. I was listening this week to, I've heard it before, but I have to be careful now. Like, I really do, because the older I get, the more my sermon illustrations become about my patients than they do about my kids anymore. So, and now all these patients are coming to church, so I'm always looking out and say, okay, can I say this? And I think we're safe this morning. But, I have this patient of mine who's about 45 that is probably acts like he's 16, and he comes in the office all the time with his mom. I think he lives with his mom, and he's not taking care of her. She's taking care of him, and he's just always on to the next thing, and he's just gotten into motocross. Yeah, I don't understand it, and he comes in, he's hurt all the time, and so I fix him up, then I walk to the front desk. And his mama comes up there, and she pays his bill. And she always says, oh, just bless his heart, you know. Bless him. What does that even mean, right? We use it so loosely, do we even think about what this blessed life is? Now, part of the challenge, I believe, and Christians too, we fall into this, but the world, the culture bleeds in, and this is what it bleeds in, that this is all there is, right? This moment, this day, this time, when we die, it's out. And if you have that mindset, what you're going to continue to do is you're going to get yours, right? You're going to take what you can get when you can get it, because if this is all there is, then why would I not? Why would I not make it about me? Why would I not be at the center of all of it? Now, that culture bleeds in to what we to what we face on a daily basis, right? So now, when we look at this word blessed, what we tend to do is look at other people's lives and say, man, they got all this. They got all the stuff. They got the big houses, they got the toys, they got the clothes, they got all this. And we look at gazing at that and say, well, God's blessed them. or maybe it's health. Maybe you look at that our health. Like, so, now, don't get me wrong, I'm all about keeping the body the temple, right? I am. But there is a point where you've got to recognize that your eyes are going to go. Right? I was watching, you know, beauty, all of it, it goes, like it changes, but it starts, the youthness leaves you. I was watching somebody on TV the other day, I promise you, I don't know what they were thinking, but they've shot their face up so much with the stuff that it looked like they were standing in front of a plane with it just, their face was blown all the way back, And I don't know at what point you think that looks good. Here we go. This is what we do. But the point is all of that's going to fade. It's going to leave you. Power. You know, even Rome here, it falls. So the problem with this word that really gets us is the culture which we live in. Now, the blessed life actually goes all the way back to Genesis. Genesis 1:28. And there, God, it says that God blessed them and invited them to partner with him. It's the first time we see it. He made humanity to be satisfied in right relationship with him. That's the blessed life. So it wasn't like he made man, you go out and do your job, and then they come back and they do a good job, and then he blesses them. No. And all these things, I'm not saying these things are bad. Some of these things are awesome, right? They are blessings. They are gifts from God. But they don't get to the heart of rightly living before God when trouble and trials come, because they come knocking. And what's crazy is after Genesis 3, so after the fall, it's not like the blessed life is taken away from us, but now it does include rightly responding to God when the brokenness of the world infringes us, when the pressures of the world push in, when we feel that squeeze. And what James is telling us here in these trials is he's asking us to ask the question, what does the blessed life look like when it meets trouble? Because, the language here is it's not if it meets trouble. It's not if you're going to get into that squeeze. It's when that happens. So what does it look like? What does that life look like after Genesis 3? And how should we rightly respond to God when the brokenness of that world pushes in? We talked about two questions the other week, if you remember, when we talked about wisdom. Two questions that we should probably always ask in the midst of what's taking place is, what is God doing right here, right now? And how do I respond to that based off of knowing that? Right? One pastor said it this way: the blessing of this passage is it's all about us learning to live the Eden life right now in the middle of the exile life. So this word blessing, it begins, we see it in Psalms 1. Blessed is the one who does not walk, sit, and stand with the wicked, but who meditates on God's word and instruction, because then they'll be like a strong tree by the river. And then the youth have been walking through the Sermon on the Mount over the last several weeks, and I was reminded this week as I was reading through that, blessed are the poor, the mourning, the meek, blessed are the pure, the peacemaker, the persecuted, because then they get the kingdom of heaven. What James is actually saying is this blessed life is how we follow Jesus into the new creation, into the new kingdom. And if you read what we just read, if you push into it, it says that God is the Father of lights. It's an echo of Genesis 1. That when we live this blessed life well, look at verse 18, we become the first fruits of the new creation. Meaning, listen to this, meaning that we are like the harvest of heaven in the here and now. It's not just a future thing. It's now. We experience eternal salvation in the middle of the destruction, in the middle of the trial, in the middle of the hurt. We taste Eden in the middle of the exile. That's the blessed life. Living rightly and ready before God, no matter what lands on your plate. That's what it means. So, now here's where it gets tricky. Because James is going to try to slow you down here because he wants you to think about it. The word, there's a word kind of you got to pay attention to here, because in verse 12 he uses the word trial. Verse 13 he uses the word tempt. The word in the Greek is the same word. The word is trouble. That's what it is. So James is making us slow down, and he says, we all go through trials, we all go through tests, but God doesn't tempt us. We bring the temptation on ourselves, and it's all the same word. Now, here's where it really is tricky, because he's talking to Jewish Christians, and they know the Old Testament, and in Genesis 22, it says now that God tested Abraham. And if the word's the same, which it is, you can read it if you have the King James, it actually says that God tempted Abraham. So what do we do with this? What do they do with this? Again, what James is wanting us to do, what he wants them to do, is when you go through trouble, the question you want to ask is, what's going on behind the scenes? What is the sovereign God doing behind the scenes? If we're seeking to trust and obey God rightly, if we're pursuing the blessed life ready, responsive to Him, and trouble comes knocking, how do I interpret the trouble? That's wisdom. So, let's try this again. Let's just use the word trouble. Verse 2. Count it all a joy when you meet troubles. Verse 12. Blessed is the one who stays true under trouble. Verse 13. But God doesn't trouble you. Verse 14, you trouble yourself. And if you want to go to Genesis 22, that God troubled Abraham. Now, here's what you need to hear. These are all the same word, but there's different kinds of troubles. I have a slide for you, I think. So we tried to make this make a little bit more sense. Temptation is internal trouble, right? It's the battle of heart and soul. That's what temptation is. Trial is external trouble. It's the pressures of a broken world that are seeping in at you. And then test is what a sovereign God does, using it all to mature our faith and make us more like Jesus. So that's how this works. God doesn't tempt us, but in every trial, God tests us. So let me give you some examples. Let's say you're a liar. We're all liars. We all lie. Let's say you are in a situation where you lie. It's a small lie, but it's a lie, and you lie to a friend, and then you turn around, and my granddad used to tell me, like, you always have to remember the lie. You don't ever have to remember the truth. Well, that's true, right? But you forget it. And so then you go, and then you tell another lie to another friend, and those two collide together, and now you've got a mess, you've got a broken relationship, and everything's just falling apart. All right, so listen to this. We're going to play a game. Is that A, about the temptation in your heart? B, the external trials and circumstances that you now have to navigate? C, is that about God trying to shape your heart by testing you? Or D, all the above? It's all of it, right? All right, here's another one. What if you're starting to get way too emotionally attached intimacy to someone at work that you're not married to? Right? What if you start to get more excited about a text, a hello from that person than your spouse? What if you feel your soul growing callous to the covenant that you made with them before God? Is that A, tempting desire that is aching in your chest? B, is that the pressure from her to keep it all, or him, to keep it all a secret? C, or is that God beckoning you to stay true, remain steadfast under the trial? D, all of the above. It's all the above. All of these and more are about our affinity to cave to sin or being sinned against, and God seeking to save us from those sins. And then he says, if we do it humbly and rightly, look at verse 12. What do you get? A crown of life. The word for that is the word Stephanos, which in the Greek culture was the wreath that was used to award victors in athletic games. Author L.T. Johnson says this: the crown of life could be understood as the crown that signifies elevation into the future life with God. So, here's what we have to ask then. What does the blessed life look like in the midst of trouble? Well, he gives you five things here. Two of those are what it doesn't look like. Three of those is what it does look like. Look at verse 13. Let no one say when they are tempted, this is all God's fault, he's tempting me. Principle is the same, because a lot of us, sometimes we blame God, but we also blame other people in the midst of our challenges, don't we? Trial, suffering, pain, surely there's somebody's fault. The question I ask here is, what is true about God? And here's what's true. God can't be tempted by evil and doesn't tempt you with evil. He doesn't. God in his very nature cannot be tempted to do or participate in evil. So in essence, James is saying because God has nothing to do with evil, we should never accuse him of trying to produce evil or sin in our lives. So while God may indeed allow trials and testing to strengthen our faith, to grow us, to produce steadfastness, he never invites you to sin in the midst of that trial or hardship. He can't do it. Like if you look at Jesus in his temptation in the wilderness, right? As one without a sin nature, Jesus was not predisposed to sin. And while this trial and testing that he experienced was certainly real, Jesus, who is both man and God, had nothing to do with sin. And as he combated Satan's lies with the truth of the word, the truth of God, so can we hold on to both as truths. Right? God cannot be tempted to do evil because God will have nothing to do with evil. And Jesus, though tested, tempted as a man, demonstrated that truth, that God will have nothing to do with evil in his perfect resistance to Satan. Now, listen to me though. God is definitely up to something in your trouble. He's there in the middle of it with you. When you feel like no one understands, when you feel like you're alone and by yourself. Now, but he is not present in order to tempt you. That's where the blame starts to come in. And we do it. We've done it in the midst of it. We blame God. Why do we blame other people, right? So, for example, what if I do something at work? It's my fault, partly my fault. Things fall apart. And we start blaming it. We start trying to figure it out, self-justifying it. So the first thing I'll do is, I don't know, 20% of it I blame God. 30% I blame my boss. He should have been paying more attention. 40% I blame the guys that are with me because they're lazy. 10% may be my fault. Now what's the problem with that? Even if it's true, what's the problem with that? I never get to the 10%. Right? I'm so busy looking at everybody else for being the problem that I never get to the 10%. Yeah, I may have some lazy people working with me. But see, if the blessing is about being postured before God rightly and ready, you can't grow into that place if you're busy accusing others for it, especially God. Like the life that he wants for you is this blessed life. But let me tell you something, blame will choke it out. It will. And he doesn't stop there. Look at 14. But each person is tempted when they are lured in and enticed by their own desire. You see, the word desire here is actually the word lust. Now, lust is a misplaced sexual longing, but actually, it's an unhealthy desire is what it is. He's teaching us, James is teaching us here, that the essence of sin is not necessarily that we want bad things, it's that we want things so badly. Too badly. We want them in the wrong way and in the wrong reasons. So here we go. It's not wrong to have money. It's not. It's wrong for money to have you. It's not wrong to have comfort. It's wrong to crave comfort for your escape. It's not wrong to have control, but it is wrong to want control in order to glorify self rather than glorify God. It's not wrong to want to be healthy, right? But it is wrong to crave a detached ideal of physical health that deters you from spiritual health. What James is teaching us is that, listen to me, when you want something too much and in the wrong way, that over-desire becomes a habit sin. And if sin is not confessed and repented, like we were just talking about, you become numb to it. You become, you don't even feel it. Augustine says this, habit, if not resisted, soon becomes necessity. And we can relate to that. And you think about the gravity of what we were just talking about with this culture bleeding in that says this is all there is. James is saying, he says that you can be a Christian, you can trust that Jesus has conquered sin and death to forgive you and welcome you into his family, and yet you can still functionally live there in death. And this is weighty, and it's hard, and it's a despairing place to be. Because you've basically killed the blessed life that you've been embodied to live in. Lust. Now, on a positive note, here we go. He turns it around. Perseverance. It fuels the blessed life. Blessed is the one who remains steadfast under trial. This is a military word. Blessed is the one who doesn't give up. Blessed is the one who doesn't give in when temptation comes knocking. This is not about yielding to blame or lust when it becomes easier to do that. And here's the strength, like here's the weird, beautiful thing about this. Because we've all walked through this. By faith, the more that you endure trials where your things and your stuff and your health and your security, all of it, your ideals, the more you're in it and they're threatened, the more you endure those trials, the more you will realize that Jesus is the purest and the truest thing that you need. He's your true security. He's your true comfort. He's showing his marginalized and his persecuted friends that their resolve to trust God when they meet trials of various kinds should be met with perseverance. And we talked about it in verse 4, and it's maturing and it's completing us and it's lacking in nothing. It fuels the blessed life. You know the other one here? It's so good. Look at verse 17. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights. It's gratitude, right? So this language of gift giving in this century was built on the cultural response of gratitude. It was attached to it. So gift and grace and thanks, they're the same word. James is saying here, every good gift and every perfect gift, he's calling us to both recognize God's gift and respond to them with gratitude. Man, we're all guilty of this. Just the common graces that God's given us. I love this time of year. I love an Indian summer, right? Because it's a little chilly in the morning, but then it's 80 degrees and that's me, right? But I love baseball. I love fishing. I love butter. I mean, I love butter. It's healthy. I think we're all just giving it a bad. I think it's really good for us. I love to sit and watch trees blow. Just like to watch. It hypnotizes me. Waves crashing. Like, these are simple things that God has given us. Man, so many times we're just happy people, but all that's based off our circumstances. The simple fact that The simple fact that he doesn't leave us in sin and death alone, that should astound us with joyful thanksgiving, gratitude. He says gratitude sustains the blessed life, is what he's telling us. And then finally, look at verse 18. Of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth that he would be a kind of first fruits. Yes, the call is to reject blame, reject lust. Yes, the call is endurance and gratitude. But we are to do these things knowing that he is the one who truly brings about life. Like we said it, but God didn't wait for us to figure it out to obey him before he blessed man. He began with the blessing. He gives the blessed life. We didn't earn it. It's grace. And in the same way, he spoke everything into being by his word, so he is the one who is bringing about the new creation by his word of truth. And all of that is Jesus. Jesus is the new Adam of the new creation. Paul says it right, bearing God's image and living the blessed life for us. We just talked about Matthew 4 when he was led into the wilderness. He felt this trial and test. The Spirit didn't tempt Jesus, but the devil put him on trial and Jesus passed the test. He didn't accuse his father. He trusted. He didn't over-desire, he depended. And then in chapter 5, he gives this message, blessed are the poor, the mourning, the meek, blessed are the pure, the peacemaker, the persecuted. And at the cross, Jesus became the blessed one. He was the Son of God who came to make peace, and by being persecuted, by taking sin and death into himself for us. All with Psalm 1 echoing in his ear why Jesus went to the exile tree of death. So we could partake in the Eden-like tree of life. He persevered. He remained steadfast in the trial. He wore a crown of thorns so we could do, like verse 12 says, we could wear a crown of life one day. This is grace. He took the sting of sin and death on himself so that if we were lured and enticed, we could also be forgiven. He rightly lived into his Father so he could bring healing to the brokenness of the world that infringes on our hearts. Every good and perfect gift is just a shadow of a gift upon gift and grace upon grace that we have in Jesus. Listen to me. The main way we reject blame and lust is by paying attention to Jesus. Believing in Jesus. Clinging to the way of Jesus. And the main way we persevere and live in gratitude is relying on Jesus. Imitating Jesus. Following the way of Jesus. I'm going to ask the team to come up. Here's the bottom line. Listen to this. Right here, right now, God isn't so much working to deliver to you your personal definition of happiness. He's not committed to giving you a predictable schedule, happy relationships, or comfortable surroundings. He hasn't promised you a successful career, a nice place to live, and a community of people who appreciate you. But what he has promised you is himself. And what he brings to you is the zeal of his transforming grace. No, he's not first working on your happiness. He's committed to your holiness. And that doesn't mean he's offering you less than you've hoped for, but much, much more. In grace, he is intent on delivering you from your greatest, deepest, and most long-term problem, sin. He offers you grace of grace that transcends the moment, that literally are the eternal value. He has not unleashed his power in your life only to deliver to you things that quickly pass and that have no capacity to all of your heart to satisfy. This means that often when you're tempted to think that God is loving you less because your life is hard, he's actually loving you more. The hardships that you are facing are the tool of his exposing, forgiving, liberating, and transforming grace. These hard moments aren't in your life because God is distant and uncaring, but rather because he loves you so fully. These moments become moments of faith and not doubt when by grace you begin to value what God is saying is truly valuable. Listen, we're going to do something different this morning. I don't know where you are, but we are going to have a time of prayer. Jonathan's going to be on one side, I'm going to be on the other side, but I want you just where you're at, I want you to just bow your heads. And I want you to ask some questions. Are you currently walking through things, troubles, trials? And in the midst of those trials, are you remaining? Or are you blaming? Are you blaming it on God? Are you blaming it on the situation? Are you blaming it on other people? As opposed to just stopping a second and looking at your own self. Maybe confession's needed this morning. Maybe it's repentance. I don't know. Maybe it's become very easy in the midst of those trials to run to something else. Augustine says that life is so much is really about ordering the things you love. It's not all bad things. But sometimes we get things out of order, right? They become idols. Maybe we just need to come up and lay those at the foot of Jesus this morning. Maybe we just need help this morning. It just feels so hard to remain under sometimes. We just need strength. Lord, would you just give us strength to remain? Maybe we need to be reminded of the things that God has done. Who he is. Our grace stories. Lord, give me a heart of gratitude. You know, it's really hard to blame. It's really hard to run to other desires when your heart's full of gratitude. But maybe, just maybe this morning, you just don't know him. Man, you may know a lot about him. But the Spirit is moving, and he's calling you home. Would you just surrender? Would you just surrender to him? He loves you so much. I'm asking Jonathan to come. We're going to be up here. Team's going to sing over you. But if you need to come this morning, would you come? Would you just come?